Hi, I'm Kate.
And I'm Lori. We've always thought that the most compelling story strikes the perfect balance between an honest look at the mess of life and the humor that can be found in the mess. To be perfectly honest, we don't really know how to live life without both the humor and the authenticity.
Our podcast might be a little bit of whiplash at times. We can spin from hard and deep to humor and laughing on a dime. The hard will be really hard, and the truths we share are the ugliest of humanity. We don't intend to make it seem like it's all fine or to pretty up the pain, but we also know that the joy we found is all the more profound because of the pain.
So we hope you can stick with us through the ugly, because there will also be joy and hope and humor. Welcome to The Ugly Truth About the Girl Next Door.
Hi, welcome back to our podcast, The Ugly Truth About the Girl Next Door. I'm Kate.
And I'm Lori. And we are back. Our episode today is the first of a two-part series called Hopeful and Afraid. We're going to be unpacking the way a trauma survivor experiences the investigation process. Our first half will be the criminal investigation process and how that's experienced by the survivor. And in the second half, we will be unpacking how it feels when private organizations do an investigation. Inappropriate, not like when you do your own investigation like we talked about before. But
that's never recommended.
Never do that. But how it feels even when an organization hires a private firm to do an investigation. So glad you're here.
Hi, and welcome back to our podcast, The Ugly Truth About the Girl Next Door. I'm Kate.
And I'm Lori.
We've officially just decided we're going to introduce ourselves. Yes.
It's happening.
It's happening. Mm-hmm. This is how we start.
We don't know how else.
Otherwise, if we don't, we have this really weird sidetrack thing that happens. Mm-hmm. So.
Not that that happens anyway.
Right? We're already sidetracked.
This is our third try every time. Okay. What are we talking about today, Kate?
So today we are going to talk about how investigations of any kind, whether that's criminal or not criminal, feel for a victim/survivor. So we talked a lot about how investigations have been done incorrectly in my story, in my case. For example, the chapel, right? Conducting their own investigation, untrained people, et cetera. The private school that I went to, again, not calling in CPS or the proper authorities, Liberty University.
Title IX violations for failing to respond appropriately to allegations of sexual assault on campus.
Exactly. So the main theme there, I guess, is untrained people, you know, doing investigations. But today we want to, so we've talked a lot about that. We've already kind of covered those bases. But today we really want to focus on what about when someone or some organization is trying to do it right? So, you know, obviously, for a lot of purposes, investigations need to be conducted. And we're not here today to say that they shouldn't be or that there isn't, you know, a need for them.
We have several times said that we really wish that somebody would do an investigation.
Yeah, we right. keep asking for a private investigator. We have, you know, talked about how the chapel should have hired an outside investigation team. So we are not here today to say that that shouldn't happen. We really, really just want to focus today on while that's all well and good, and while there is a time and a place for that to happen, there is still a certain kind of way that it feels for a victim, for a survivor, for me. Mm-hmm. So I think it's easy for a lot of people, and, you know, I mean, maybe not to, I'm not passing judgment in this statement. I'm just saying that I think it's easy for someone who is either not a victim or even for someone who is a survivor, but has never been the subject of an investigation, to say, you know, well, that's a good thing. Like, let them investigate. If you have nothing to hide and you're not lying, then the truth will prevail. And what's the problem, right? And yes, that's true. But that doesn't take away from the fact that the reality is that, why did you make that small?
I'm going to make it big again.
Oh, my goodness.
Down.
You know I'm blind.
Well, I'm not asking you to read it. I'm trying to find a little bit about the statistics. Hang on.
Where oh, is I put it? Them someplace else.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
We'll guess. We'll come back. This?
Are you sassing me right now? Okay. Okay, fine. We'll talk about that later.
Okay.
What I was going to say is, and we'll talk about the specifics, but that there's tons of research that looks at how investigations feel for the survivor. And it's predominantly negative.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not because anyone is necessarily doing it wrong.
Right.
But because it, there are ways that it feels, and that's what we're going to talk about today.
Right. So I guess let's just start with, you know, the difference between a criminal investigation versus a different, any other kind of investigation, because a lot of times the standard that everybody wants to jump to and use is the highest standard, which is in our criminal prosecution system.
We keep hearing people say, why don't we, even with the Matariza thing, like so many people, again, mostly I feel positive, honestly, I feel like most people were in support of the fact that there needed to be some appropriate action taken. But there were a lot of people who were like, what happened to innocent till proven guilty? Okay. If I hear that one more time, my head might explode. Because the truth is that is completely appropriate for criminal prosecution. Mm-hmm. Okay. The burden of proof for a criminal prosecution is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So in order to convict you of a crime, a prosecutor must prove your guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. This burden means the prosecution has to show there's no other reasonable explanation for the evidence as it presents, the highest. And that is to protect people from being sent to jail for long periods of time for something that they didn't actually do. Mm-hmm. Okay. Which is, we want that in our justice system.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's also not the say all and the end all. It just, okay.
Just because there's not proof beyond a reasonable doubt doesn't mean somebody didn't do it.
Exactly.
So the next step down, and again, this is all legal jargon, right? So the next step down from proof beyond a reasonable doubt is clear and convincing evidence. And this burden of proof is most common in family law cases like custody and stuff, and administrative law cases. So this level of proof is not as high as beyond a reasonable doubt, but is the highest standard in non-criminal cases. It requires proof that a fact is highly and substantially more likely to be true than false. So more likely true than false, highly and substantially. So again, that's still, if it can't be proven with clear and convincing evidence, that still doesn't mean it didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And then the third burden of proof level is preponderance of the evidence. This burden of proof is most common in civil lawsuits. Under a preponderance standard, a plaintiff must prove their case against a defendant is more likely than not. It's like the 51%. Right? So 51% true, we're calling that preponderance of the evidence. Okay, so let me just say, if in a civil lawsuit, the burden of proof is 51%, like you just have to be like, 50-50, but I'm leaning toward this being true.
51-49.
That's enough for a civil lawsuit for there to be a judgment against the plaintiff, against the defendant, against the person who's, I don't even know. Okay. So somebody's getting in trouble
now.
Right. So why can't preponderance of the evidence be the way that our society functions? Mm-hmm. Why do we act like the only level of appropriate burden of proof is beyond a reasonable doubt?
But that is what I don't even think that the vast majority of people probably know these other standards unless you are like a law student or right. like an attorney.
Right? Or had a cause to know about
right.
it.
Right. So, but yeah, it's always like everybody loves that tagline, innocent until proven guilty. And that's just not, especially when you look at the statistics, right? Especially when you say, okay, 90 to 98% of sexual abuse allegations are then later considered true. So like, you can't say that and then also look at the statistics of, okay, but out of every 100 sexual assaults, only 3 of those are actually, the perpetrator is actually incarcerated. So those statistics do not match. So that can't be the right. standard to which we hold every single sexual abuse, sexual assault allegation. It just can't be.
Well, not if we don't want predators being around our children.
Right.
Or continuing to victimize even adults.
Right. So all of that sounds like, okay, good, great.
Okay, but now we need to talk about what's it like to be the survivor walking around a world where the general population thinks of it as what happened to innocent and to proving guilty. And unless somebody is proven guilty in a court of law, we don't believe it's true. Mm-hmm. So now we need to talk about what does that feel like to be the victim survivor walking around like that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Feels like a whole crap load of garbage. Is what it feels like. So
we're going to talk about that. We also, though, need to talk about what is it like to have to be the victim experiencing the investigation process itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, okay. A criminal investigation, the general process of, like we said, a legal criminal investigation. This does not, you know, this is just the standard in society. A lot of times, I think you said that a victim tells a family or family member or friend first. Depending on what that person's response is, has a significant impact on whether or not they even report to law enforcement, which I would definitely agree with that. Does that person see the importance of reporting? Do they believe that law enforcement will be helpful? Will they be sensitive? Do they act supportive or blaming? So when a victim is already spinning with all the ways that they think they did it wrong, any response to that at all pointing blame anywhere but the offender would shut it down and kind of further wound the victim. Again, before we like launch into this, I just want to make it very clear that even the best case scenario, even the best detectives, the best law enforcement agents that we have worked with that I have ever come across, they are not Olivia Benson. Right. This is not TV. And so they can be excellent at their job and still it feels garbagey to be me in this process. Right. So then the first contact with law enforcement and or the medical community. You can do this one.
Okay. So it's important to recognize that in order to do a criminal prosecution, again, we're not just talking about an awareness in the society that this person has done something very terrible. We're talking about the standard of evidence for criminal prosecution. There has to be evidence collected, mm-hmm. right? That's just how our system works. And we're glad that it works that way so that somebody can't just be in a bad mood and throw someone in jail. Okay. But that means that a rape victim has to go through the extremely invasive experience of having a rape kit collection of physical evidence. And that's supposed to happen no more than 48 hours following an assault. The sooner the better. So immediately following a trauma, the victim has to allow a stranger to poke and prod around all the places that were just traumatized and are wounded and to be, again, frankly, violated that way. When they are still just trying to catch their breath. Swabs are taken, internal exams, photographs of bruising and injury, clothing confiscated. Like, it is extremely invasive. And nobody's saying that that is not a necessary part of a criminal prosecution, but it's really important to recognize. So when we're sitting around saying, why didn't she go to the police? Well, okay, how about that as a reason?
Also, it's so different from any other kind of crime, right? If someone breaks into your house, so the police maybe come and take pictures of, you know, where the breaking and entering happened.
Even if you were assaulted, like punched in the face.
Yeah, they would maybe take a picture of the bruise on your face. But I mean, this is like,
private parts.
Most invasive, yes, thing that nobody would ever, ever, ever in a million years put themselves through.
Okay, women out there, we know what it's like to go through a gynecologic exam, having a baby where like the whole world is there, it seems. It is very vulnerable and nobody enjoys that process, obviously.
Right.
So how about when you've just been traumatized?
Right. And then there's the filing of the police report. A lot of times a police officer will come to the hospital. Again, you've just gone through this horrific event, this horrific trauma. Now you've gone through this horrific collection of evidence. And now a police officer is standing in front of you wanting to ask questions. And again, the standard is that way because the sooner they're able to talk to the victim, the quicker they're able to like collect, you know, take the statement, the memory is clearer, makes sense. But imagine being the victim, right? So another person yet again asking the details of what happened. This officer may or may not even be the right person as well. It could literally just be a responding officer.
Usually that's the case. Let's face it. They're not sending their detectives. It's not Olivia Benson. Nope. She doesn't meet you at the hospital.
No.
You first, somebody calls 911 and they send whoever is the person nearest and available.
Exactly. So it's literally like a beat cop responding.
Who's like 25 at best.
Not that we've had experience.
No. Not that we've experienced this. Right. So again, it doesn't mean that they're not good. Honestly, I feel like those are not bad experiences necessarily. However,
right. Absolutely. So again, is that person responsive? Are the police responsive? Is the detective that is supposed to be the one to eventually take the case responsive? Or like the, you know, Matt Ariza's victim, are they sitting around waiting in a police station for 5 hours until someone can get around to interview them? It's really 50-50 on that one.
Probably not even. Right. Because again, a lot of these things don't happen in the middle of the day.
No, right? Of course not. No,
they have to call a detective from wherever.
Yeah, exactly. Are the police sensitive, right? They're asking questions like, are they asking questions like, what were you wearing? Or, you know, or are they saying things like, sometimes there can be important evidence on clothing. Can you tell us what clothes you had on at the time? It's all about phrasing, right? Are they trauma informed? Again, nobody is saying that police are the way that they are because that's how they do their job well. 110%.
And then they become more like that over time, right? So here's how I think of it. When you've got a young officer in front of you, they maybe don't have the experience, but most of them went into law enforcement because truly, I think like they want to help stop bad things from happening.
Right.
Right. There's also a power and control element there, just saying, but there's also, they do want to stop bad things from happening. But they're young and inexperienced, but then as they get older, they have much more experience, but they're also probably kind of jaded and somewhat burnt out. And again, you hope that it doesn't quite go too much that way, but that's the risk. Mm-hmm. So who are you getting? You don't get to choose
who you talk to. It depends on where the crime happened. It depends on what county you're in, what city you're in, what, you know.
And good luck or bad luck.
Right. Who's and sometimes on duty? There's one detective for the entire county who handles sex crimes, right?
And maybe they suck.
Right.
We can cut that.
Nope. I don't think we should. So yeah, are they trauma informed? Do they understand the impact of trauma on memory? Do they give the victim encouragement when it's messy? Do they make it easy or difficult for victims to share their experience? So, I just want to insert here the role of an advocate.
Okay. Advocates can be officially appointed, like,
yes. So crisis services, you know, and so in our area in either Erie County or Niagara County, there are crisis services, available in which a sexual assault advocate can be called in to sit with the victim, to do all of these things, hopefully understand the impact of trauma on memory and how they can then encourage, you know, the survivor to take breaks, like be there to kind of hold their hand. However, many, many times the advocates in our area they're volunteers, and there are a lot of times, nothing against this, but they are like students who are maybe going to go into the field of social work or, you know, mental health counseling. They're young people who don't mind being up all hours of the night to be on call. They're not typically professional people who would be. Right. So they may be.
Maybe it's a survivor who wants to give back, right?
Right. But, they're volunteers.
Right.
Which there's nothing wrong with that.
But it's now.
Right.
The luck of the draw.
Exactly. So maybe you get someone who's amazing, and maybe you get a 12-year-old who just rolled out of bed to be there and is handing you just a piece of paper. You know, like, it's luck of the draw. So there's that, the trauma-informed element. And then there's the following up with police and the waiting. So I don't have the statistics offhand, but there is a statistic out there about how many rape kits have been completed. Survivor has gone through all of those steps, has done the, you know, invasive thing at the hospital, has talked to police, has filed a police report, and those rape kits are sitting in storage somewhere waiting to be processed. So that in and of itself is like, you have to know for sure that if you're going to go through this process, that something beneficial is going to come out of it. And a lot of times, the vast majority of times, it doesn't.
Right. I mean, so the statistics are that of 100 rapes that are committed, between 5 and 20 are reported, less than five are prosecuted, less than five of those, less than five result in a conviction, and less than three result in incarceration. So 100 rapes, mm-hmm. three result in incarceration.
Right.
So how many women, how many people, survivors are going through the excruciating experience of an investigation? Okay, Silas, I took away one toy because I thought it was being too noisy. So we brought the speaker.
I got another one.
Okay, here we go. Okay.
Nice try.
Okay. So that, great. Okay.
It's like the exact same toy in a different color.
Anyhow, oh my gosh. You go. Little, yeah. So very important to just realize that there are 100 people who have now faced the horrendousness of a rape experience. 5 to 20 are brave enough, willing to go through reporting it, and less than three result in get incarceration.
Right. So as a survivor, and especially when we then translate that into like a trafficking situation where it's repeated trauma, really weighing out what the benefit of any investigation is going to be is like, I don't even know how to put words to that, right? Like, I don't.
Well, look at the girl in the Matt Ariza case,
right?
So this incident happened over a year ago, and the offender is still walking around, signing NFL contracts, getting paid. By the way, what I read is, yeah, he lost a great big giant contract, but he still got paid. He was guaranteed $250,000.
Yeah, no.
While this allegation was out there. Can you imagine what that felt like to be that young woman?
No.
Knowing that she had done all the right things, that he did this thing, and he's now getting paid $250,000. Up until recently, it was like millions.
Right.
Not okay.
Yeah.
So there's a 2008 Michigan State University study that found that as a result of contact with the legal system, 87% of survivors felt bad about themselves. 71% felt depressed, 53% felt distrustful of others, and 80% were less likely to seek other help. Okay.
That's so sad, but honestly, like, not even a little bit shocking. Like I said, it's...
Right.
Yeah.
Horrendous. Yeah. So when you ask, again, when you ask yourself, why would a victim survivor be reluctant to report? There you go. That's why, because who you already feel bad about themselves, but 87% feel bad about themselves as a result of contact with the legal system. So this is not because you were raped. I mean, yes, you have all kinds of feelings about that, but we're talking 87% of survivors feel bad about themselves because of their involvement with law enforcement. Mm-hmm. Wow. That's not okay.
So we're also not saying here, don't report it.
Correct.
We're at not all. We're just, again, trying to highlight for people who are not a survivor, not a victim, we're trying to highlight how easy it is for you to say, oh, good, an investigation is being done. But the reality for the victim is really much different than just like, oh, good, yay, you know. But I mean, yeah, we're not at all saying don't report it. There was just a recent sting operation in Florida where 160 men who were participating in a trafficking ring were arrested, including the deputy police chief, which, yeah, if you follow our Instagram at all, we had posted about. Okay, so that's kind of just a really high-level general overview of a criminal investigation.
So I just want to, again, highlight, I'm glad that we're talking about the difference, the distinction between a criminal investigation and a more private investigation. Because it's not that they don't feel in similar kinds of ways to the survivor or victim. But again, I just want to make sure people are connecting to the idea that the burden of proof appropriately is much higher in a criminal investigation. Mm-hmm. So that is the end of part one of our two-part series of Hopeful and Afraid. Hopefully you're getting a sense of, you know, the push-pull between being hopeful that there will be help and being well aware of the need for this kind of an investigation, but also the fear of just how overwhelming the whole experience is for the survivor victim. Next time we will unpack in more detail how it feels to be the survivor in a more private sector investigation, including a lot of the feelings of, you know, having people poking around in your experiences. So thanks for being with us. If you or someone you know is stuck in a trafficking situation and needs help, please reach out to the National Human Trafficking Hotline by calling 1-888-373-7888 or text HELP, H-E-L-P, to 233-733.